Could I just say, I'm giving five lectures in this mini course, and this is the third of them. This is the last one this term. There are two next term. The first one's on 10th of January, so I hope if you're going to come to that, you won't have forgotten all the things that I was trying to say in these ones. It's nice to see so many people here, but it is a bit of a chaotic up there, so if you could either find seats or something would be useful. I think I've got to start anyway, though, if you don't mind. Forgive me, all the people upstairs. The term third way, the concept third way politics, as I'm sure most people here would know, has proved very controversial. You only have to open the Guardian newspaper to see how it's regularly dumped on and to see the kind of crass responses, really, if I might say so, of good sections of the British press. But I feel much of this criticism is based upon misunderstandings, and therefore it's important for me to do my best, I think, to clarify further what it means. I tried to give you in the last lecture an overall view of what the third way debate is all about, but there are a number of core misunderstandings which I think it's important to try to clear up. First, the third way is not a middle way between something like a market-based philosophy on the one hand and a left of center or a socialist philosophy on the other. It is not a middle way. It is not a compromise form of politics. In the 1930s, the person who was to become British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, wrote a book called The Middle Way, actually. And there have been quite a few books, articles called The Middle Way. The third way is not a middle way. The third way is a label for the attempt to develop a coherent left of center political philosophy in the context of a world in big social change. It's important to reaffirm that. As I mentioned last time, it doesn't matter really whether you use the term, but as I'll mention in a minute, there is some reason to carry on using it, but for me it refers to an attempt to update left of center philosophies in social conditions under which many pre-existing policies and orientations no longer work or have become obsolete. Second, the term third way is often associated with either particular politicians or particular countries, especially I think Bill Clinton in the United States and Tony Blair in this country. This is wrong. The term third way has nothing to do, in my view, nothing directly to do with the policies of any particular politician, and is certainly not to be identified with the social structure of any specific country, such as the United States or Britain. Now, there are reasons why people sometimes associate the term third way with the kind of Clinton-Blair axis, and this is that the concept of third way was reintroduced into contemporary politics by none other than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was the first contemporary major politician to resurrect the term third way, which he used in the early 1990s in a State of Union, the Union address, and was then picked up by Tony Blair and further popularized by him. But in my view, third way, it's a much, much broader concept. It refers to a whole diversity of means whereby left-of-center political parties have attempted to update their policies to come to terms with the new demands of our time. So for me, if you look at the policies introduced, say, in Denmark since the early 1990s, primarily by left-of-center parties, or in the Netherlands, or in Spain by the socialists in the latter part of González's government, or in Portugal today by the left-of-center coalition or government in power in Portugal, or indeed innovations made by Gerhard Schröder in Germany or by Jospin in France. In spite of differences of rhetoric, you'll find that every significant left-of-center political party in Europe has restructured its agenda over the past 10 to 15 years. They've had to do so because of the pressures of change that I've mentioned. And it's very striking if you look across the political programs and policies of the 11 or 12 left of center governments in power in Europe, in the European Union countries at the moment, there is a striking similarity between them. You find, for example, differences of rhetoric, famously between Lionel Jospin's socialists in France and Tony Blair's Labour Party in this country, but the policies they follow are largely similar. And they all, I would say, all left of center parties have reconstructed their ideas around the main points I mentioned last time. Recognition that government is often a problem, not the solution, concern with civil society, massive investment in infrastructure, education, skills in the economy, transformation of the welfare state, sensitivity to ecological issues, and a new orientation to the international arena. I don't think you find a single left of center party which in some sense is not trying to come to terms with these issues. And that does take you away from classical social democracy, let alone classical socialism of the post-war period. So it doesn't matter whether the party chooses still to call itself socialist or not, the overall framework of policy is actually remarkably similar. Some writers have argued that there's more similarity between left of center parties in the EU today than there's ever been before, because of common dialogue and interchange around these issues and the kind of mutual shaping of policy. Although that's quite controversial, because there still are differences. Parties share a framework, but of course the needs of particular countries vary. So you wouldn't expect, for example, Gerhard Schröder's SPD in Germany have exactly the same policies as Tony Blair in this country. For instance, in this country, in my view anyway, you have far too much poverty, too much inequality, less of a problem in Germany than it is here. Prime issue in Germany is long-term structural unemployment on a kind of partially frozen economy in which you're either inside or outside. Big division between insiders and outsiders in the contemporary German system. So you wouldn't say the trajectory of policies would be identical, but the overall framework is pretty similar. Now, Schröder's SPD or Jospin's socialists are parties that don't like the term third way. That's fine, doesn't matter at all. So I stress again, the policy orientations and shifts have a great deal in common across Europe, as they should do, and the terminology is not so relevant to that. Third, many people argue that what you're talking about here is essentially Western politics that concerns only the industrial countries and has no relevance to the developing regions or poorer regions of the world. This is a variant, really, of debates about globalization, which I'll be discussing a bit later in some more detail in the lectures next term. This, in my view, is also completely wrong. It's completely wrong to argue that the third way debate is only a debate relevant to the advanced economies or the industrial societies or the Western countries. The reasons for this, I think, perfectly clear. Doesn't matter whether you're in a poorer country or a richer country, you must respond to the same changes. The global economy is not someone's imagination, it is real. We all know, surely, that what happens in Brazil or Argentina or other parts of the so-called developing world closely linked into what happens elsewhere and vice versa. Just a fact of a globalizing economy, this is so. The global economy is also increasingly becoming a knowledge economy, and this will affect poorer countries just as much as it affects richer ones. Therefore, we're all in the same debate, because it doesn't matter where one is in the world, the two pre-existing philosophies that I mentioned last time have lost their purchase there too. We know that traditional socialism, state-based Keynesian socialism, has no significant application in Latin America, Asia, or elsewhere. It does not promote economic development. But we know also that the era of neoliberalism is drawing to a close, and that free market economies have proved also to be ineffective, especially in coping with issues of poverty and large-scale inequality in the world. That's why it doesn't matter what country one is in, the same debate is relevant. Less developed countries need to find a different political philosophy too. Now, of course, that won't look the same. Just as as countries in Europe differ in their needs and their trajectories, their institutions. This is true on a more massive scale if you're comparing, say, Mexico with the UK, or Argentina with France, or Taiwan with a European country, whatever it might be. But the overall framework of debate has now become a global thing. That's why I carry on using myself the term third way, because it has caught on across the world in an extraordinary fashion. There are now left-of-center governments who call themselves third way governments, left-of-center political leaders in some 40 countries across the world, ranging from Taiwan through Korea through to Latin American countries and elsewhere. So this has become a genuinely global political engagement. There are many problems to be resolved in it, as I'll come on to immediately, but the purchase of the third way debate has itself become largely global. And we'll have to look at the consequences of that primarily in subsequent lectures rather than in this one. Now, of course, the critics have a lot to say about the attempt to introduce an effective centre-left political philosophy in the contemporary world. And there are three types of criticism which I'd like to concentrate on in this lecture and in the two subsequent lectures next term in this course. First type of criticism comes, or critical orientation, if you like, comes primarily from the political right or from those who argue that globalization has rendered nations, national power, political power obsolete. First type of criticism argues that as a result of the globalization of the world marketplace, political power has lost most of its significance anyway. Nation states have lost most of their power, so how can national politicians have any impact, really, either on their own nations or certainly on the wider global arena? So this type of criticism simply tends to say, well, all this debate is largely irrelevant because the big forces that move the world are markets, big corporations. Nations are becoming progressively less important anyway, so we simply have to dispense with the role which we used to allocate to politics and government. I picked up quite a little smidgen of that standing behind some couple of people when I was trying to, you know how hard it was to get into this room, it's very hard to get out. I was trying to get out last week after last lecture, and someone was saying, well, you know, what, politics isn't interesting to me, and I'm not interested in all this talk about politics, the real forces moving the world, corporations, markets. So that criticism has to be responded to. I'll be concentrating on this issue in this particular lecture. From the left, you have two further, mainly from the political left anyway, two further critical orientations that I'll be dealing with in the fourth and fifth lectures next term. The first of these criticisms is that third way politics, or the new center left, is not able to cope with the expanding inequalities produced by globalization, the expanding divisions between the richer countries of the world and the poorer countries of the world, and that global inequality needs, in some sense, some alternative political program, perhaps involving rolling back the forces of globalization. This is, I suppose, what the protesters on the streets of Seattle wanted, to push back the forces which they see as dividing the world, as increasing these awful divisions between an elite of rich countries and at the bottom a segment of very, very poor countries with many people living in the most appalling conditions. That's, if you like, the debate about global inequality. So I'll be talking about that in the fourth lecture. The second criticism, which I'll discuss in the fifth lecture, brings one back again to the developing world. This is the idea that third way politics, as I mentioned earlier, is simply a Western project, and that the developing world needs something different. So that most of this discussion is kind of Europo or Westo-centric, and the developing world, so it's argued, is somehow excluded from this discourse and excluded from these policies and their implications. So let me this lecture concentrate on the issue of government, the state, political power, what significance these have in relation to a political program of the kind such as I outlined last time. There are two aspects to the state, really, that you have to discuss here. One is the nation state, the state as nation, the state as a territorial entity. Is the nation state becoming obsolete in the global era? Has power been drained away from it? Is the crucial source of power today really transnational corporations? Have we simply to give up on the ancient left of center idea that government is necessary to create a just society? If the nation state has indeed lost most of its power, I think a good deal of the aims of the center left, certainly national center left parties, would inevitably be doomed to failure. They simply would be moved by forces which governments are impotent to control. Second aspect of the state is the state as welfare system, or the welfare state. Welfare state concerns aspects of social provision. The welfare state is largely a post-Second World War creation, and I'll say a bit later in this lecture what one ordinarily means by that, but the critique also runs that welfare states can no longer be sustained in the traditional fashion. The welfare era is over. Welfare state is doomed to decline. We can't afford to pay for welfare systems anymore. The global marketplace, again, should be substituted for welfare institutions. That's actually the driving force of a good deal of right of center political rhetoric, really. The idea that the state is the enemy and the object of politics should be to reduce the role of the state as far as possible. The right, of course, tends to concentrate on the second aspect of the state, reducing the welfare state rather than the first, as a particular view of the continuing role of the nation state. Well, is it true that nation states are declining in the current era? And what exactly can we expect to happen to the nation state in this extraordinarily intensifying global age? Well, there are three aspects of this issue that I'd like to separate out. First of all, the issue of whether nations are becoming less important and less powerful in the global era. The answer to this, I think, you can be fairly unequivocal about. That is, the answer to this, by and large, is no. Certainly as a generalization, the answer to this, I think, has to be no. You could almost reverse the conventional idea that nation states are becoming less important, less powerful. You could argue this is the first time at which the nation state has become a universal political form. Because until the current era, there were always, as I think I mentioned in the very first lecture, rivals to nation states. In other words, nation states existed alongside empires and other political formations. The collapse of Soviet Union, 1989, probably the last phase of an imperial system in the contemporary world. Now the nation state form has become universal. And I think although it's plain that nations can no longer follow Keynesian policies, that nations have lost some aspects of the economic power that they used to have, I think you can also plainly see that nations, or at least I believe anyway, are more important than corporations are. It's not true to say that corporate power is replacing national power in the contemporary world. The reasons for this are that nations simply control resources, territory, military power, framework of law, the corporations do not. National power, therefore, and the nation state, to me, remain central in a global age. And I think national governments, especially when acting collectively, can do an enormous amount, including an enormous amount relevant to ecological issues, to remedying global inequality, and other problems. Our possibility of making an impact on these problems is not going to rest primarily with international organizations. I don't think it's going to rest primarily with the United Nations, not going to rest primarily with the IMF or World Bank. It's going to rest still for the foreseeable future, primarily in the hands of nations, and they have to act collaboratively in order to achieve an impact on the global issues, which I'll be discussing in the last two lectures. So by and large, it's certainly not true to say this era is the era of the end of the nation state, and it is an era, I would say, where government becomes more important rather than less. However, you have to recognize that government doesn't simply mean national level government. You have to include government above the level of the nation and also government below the level of the nation. However, nations will still play a crucial role in both these forms of governance, and again, I'll be discussing them in a subsequent lecture. However, in contemporary times, the nation, I think, is becoming reshaped. And I like to speak of the rise of what I call the cosmopolitan nation, where I think our future really rests. Nations in the past developed as fiercely territorial and were linked to the prosecution of wars. The rise of the nation state very much bound up with the fighting of wars and with the levying of taxes in order to fight those wars. But we live in an era, I think, in the new global age where these things are manifestly no longer so important as they were. We have to think, reconstruct the nation as less territorial than nations have been in the past, and is not so determined by the overall goal of resisting other nations, conquering them, invading their territories, and so forth. The cosmopolitan nation, as I would see it, is an attempt to rethink the history of a nation and to rethink it in such a way as to promote collaboration in an increasingly interdependent world of nations, rather than depending upon the traditional criteria that used to define what nations are all about. And personally, I think on the best scenario, this is what is actually happening in the European Union. I don't see the European Union as an organization which is transcending nation states. I see the European Union as a transnational form of governance within which it's possible to restructure and to reaffirm national identity, but in such a way that it is no longer shaped by the conflicts of the past. And I think whichever country you go to, whether it's this one, where it's plainly a massive process of rethinking a British national identity, or any other European country, Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, Greece, there is a conscious, partly conscious attempt to rethink the identity of the nation. That means rethinking the past and using a rethinking of the past to reassert national identity in the future, but in a very different context from those forces which shaped the nation in the past. I think nations remain important. I don't think the European Union, for example, will supplant nations in people's consciousness, nor probably should it do so. In my view, it's a great mistake to think of the European Union as a kind of analogy to the United States and to see it as somehow creating a United States of Europe. The EU, for me, is an association of nations who have pooled their sovereignty, who have combined aspects of their sovereignty in order to reassert their own identity in a collaborative framework. That's why the European Union is so important as a bridgehead to global governance. The European Union points the way to other possible developments in different regions of the world which could follow the same trajectory. It's an experiment, of course. But the cosmopolitan nation can be a means of identity for people. It can still be a means of citizenship for people. But it won't be a nation, I think, with the same kind of territorial insistence as nations have had in the past. And therefore, when you look at specific policies of the European Union, such as the Schengen agreements, if you know Schengen agreements, they are agreements to abolish passport controls at the boundaries between participating states in the European Union. Policies like the Schengen agreements plainly map a new path for the nation, no longer defined by the same jealous territoriality as in the past. There are powerful structural reasons why the cosmopolitan nation could be not just a utopian ideal. And this is because of the third factor I feel affecting nation states, which is that we now, for the most part, at least in many parts of the world, especially in Europe, but also in some other core parts of the world, live in a world where we can speak of nations without enemies. I think you look back into history of the nation state, nations have been defined through their enemies. You look back to the Cold War period, many of our institutions, including the nation, defined by our enemies, the Cold War division of the world. That division of the world has now been transcended. It follows, I think, if you think of a country like the UK, or most of the countries in the European Union, they just don't have specific enemies in the way in which they used to do. Therefore, you can't use enemies as a means of defining identity in the way in which it used to be so characteristic of nation states. Of course, people search for them, Islamic fundamentalism or whatever it might be. But in the European Union, it's no longer clear that, and nor is it the case, I think, that nations are shaped through specific enemies, which are, as it were, the negative forces which make you feel that you belong to a particular nation and that you have a role in history. This doesn't mean, of course, that wars disappear, but it's equally plain, I think, that wars are changing their nature, and that in the future, wars will tend to be what Mary Kaldor calls new wars rather than old wars. She distinguishes old wars versus new wars. Old wars are wars between nations. They are the characteristic form of traditional warfare. New wars are wars around the edges of nations where there isn't sufficient sovereignty. So they are the kinds of wars you find in ex-Yugoslavia, parts of Africa, East Timor, and so on. They're not wars between nations. They're wars which have to be managed by the international community. And you might say in the case of Kosovo, maybe it wasn't managed in the right way. Very hard historically to say whether that's true. But the management of local wars increasingly looks likely, and I think we have to hope that it will, replace traditional national wars. I think there are other parts of the world besides Europe, such as Latin America, where the situation also holds. And I think it's particularly in Asia and Africa that you still have a strong residue of traditional old-style wars in the Mary Kaldor terminology. Living in a nation without enemies isn't easy, I think, because enemies did shape the history of nations. But I think you can see from the emerging European Union that it is certainly not a utopian project. You do see this transformation already happening. I feel a great deal of the possibility of producing a more effectively peaceful world will depend upon whether these developments can be furthered. They don't involve the end of the nation state. They don't involve the idea of a simply interdependent cosmopolitan community. I think people will still need to identify with nations because they're much closer, as it were, at hand than any world community or even European community can be. These things having been said, therefore, I think one can still say the nation state is going to be at the core of contemporary politics. Who controls nations will be very powerful, both within and outside them. They need to use this power to help reshape national identity itself. It's not insignificant that, in spite of the fact that people say politicians have no more power, when you look at, for example, the Observer list of the 300 most powerful people in the UK, it's Tony Blair who tops the list. Well, this is right and proper because political power is still crucial to the shaping of states in the contemporary world. Therefore, the restructuring of governance is still essential for us. A crucial part of the Third Way project has to be rescuing the power of government, not further undermining it, but translating that power into a regional and international arena, not just leaving it at a national one. The second aspect of all this, of course, is the welfare state and what should happen to it, because the welfare state is crucially bound up with national citizenship. I think if you look back in history, when people look to create the good society, they often thought that it would be international. But citizenship has been mainly a national creation. And the welfare systems that have been created to support citizenship themselves have been universally national creations. What is the welfare state? I think I should explain briefly in case anyone is not clear in their own minds what it is. The welfare state refers to the use of state power to further and normally to finance key aspects of people's fate in a contemporary society. The welfare state normally includes state funding, state management of most aspects of education, of most aspects of health and healthcare systems, of most aspects of social security, provision for unemployment, and so forth, and of most aspects of pensions and pension payments. Those, together with a number of other more minor tasks, comprise what one normally calls the welfare state. The welfare state is essentially a post-Second World War creation of the industrial countries. Most less developed countries do not have welfare states, do not have developed welfare institutions. In Europe, it's normally recognized that there are several different kinds of welfare systems or welfare states. There is not a single welfare state. The most famous sort of typology of this is by the Danish writer Gospa Esping Andersen, who wrote a celebrated book called The Three Worlds of Welfare Capitalism. And he distinguished three types of welfare state. First of all is the Scandinavian type. Second, there's the Central European or continental welfare state. And third, there is the Anglo-Saxon. Many people also add a fourth, which they call the Mediterranean type. Scandinavian system, pretty obvious where that is. Central European normally includes countries like France, Germany, Italy. Anglo-Saxon, not just the UK, US, but also Australia, Canada, so forth. Mediterranean, usually Spain, Portugal, Greece, the main countries. Scandinavian welfare state famously has been the most generous welfare system, supported by high levels of taxation. Fundamental difference between the Scandinavian countries and most of the other EU countries is that for whatever reason, Scandinavian populations will tolerate a higher level of overall taxation than other European countries will. Still true today, the Scandinavian countries have considerably higher levels of overall taxation than other EU countries and the United States and Australia and so forth do. And they use a good deal of this taxation directly to fund the welfare state. Scandinavian welfare state, therefore, is a generous welfare state with many universal benefits sustained from a higher level of taxation than you can persuade other European populations to pay. It's mainly supported by central taxation. Central European type is still quite a generous welfare system, although not as generous as the Scandinavian one. It's supported much more from employers' contributions, taxation on employers, rather than direct income tax, direct state taxation. Often involves kind of mixed funding. The Anglo-Saxon welfare state operates with a lower level of overall taxation. It was true historically, still true today. Anglo-Saxon countries don't seem willing to pay the same level of taxation, the electorate doesn't seem willing, as is true of the other types. Hence, this is much more targeted benefit system in the Anglo-Saxon type. Most or a higher proportion of benefits are targeted to, for example, the poor or the unemployed, rather than being universal. The Mediterranean type is a developing welfare system because Portugal, Spain, Greece did not have established welfare states of the kind which you find in Central and Northern Europe. Now, all of these forms of welfare state are being affected by the same trends. The history of the welfare state is one of progressive expansion of welfare institutions until about the late 1970s or so, mid to late 1970s, followed by a tailing off of funding in most countries. Part of the reason for that is simply that welfare states in many countries became unsustainable. Welfare states were largely funded by borrowing, advanced borrowing, and in some countries, by the early 1980s, simply repaying the interest on borrowing consumed a massive amount of GDP. In Belgium, for example, at one point, or in Italy, 10% of GDP was spent simply on paying the interest on money owed to fund welfare institutions. So the welfare state throughout Europe and other countries ran up against what was often called a fiscal crisis in the from the early period of the 1980s onwards, connected with demographic trends. This is one reason why one mustn't blame everything on globalization. Demographic trends strongly affected the future of welfare systems, mainly, especially aging populations. All industrial countries have aging populations. Very high proportion of the population is becoming in the older age categories as compared to the past. That means you don't have the younger workers to support the pension commitments made, and several countries have more or less completely unsustainable pension commitments for the future. These are not, however, the main reason why welfare states need reconstructing, and they're not the basis of how you would approach such a reconstruction from a third way political point of view. The main basis for reconstructing the welfare state is as follows, and these are changes which link very closely to the ones I've described in previous lectures. First, the welfare state is essentially a risk management system. Many people think of the welfare state as primarily a means of redistributing income, but that was never its prime rationale, and that was never its prime accomplishment. The welfare state is essentially a collectively funded risk management system, existing alongside private insurance and so forth. It began as a passive risk management system, and what it has to do today is to move towards a much more active risk management system. The welfare state, as it developed in Western Europe, presumed conditions that don't exist today. It presumed a fairly passive citizenry. So the risks which affect you were treated as though they simply come from the outside. You get unemployed, the welfare state is there to protect you. Get divorced, the welfare state is there to protect you. Get ill, the welfare state is there to take care of you. None of this presumed an active, involved, and responsible citizenry. Well, as a result of the changes I mentioned in the first lecture, this is no longer the case. In an open information society with a great deal of individual freedom, you cannot any longer have simply a passive risk management system. You must insist upon the assumption of responsibilities from those who get welfare rights throughout the welfare system. You need a more active risk management system. This is partly because the risks we face are new. So if you think of healthcare, for example, you can no longer treat healthcare as simply passive risk management because we know that ecological factors affect the health of populations. You must have active policies for those. And because we know that lifestyle decisions, what people eat, how they live, these also affect people's health. So you must try and encourage responsible behavior on the part of populations. You need a different pattern of risk management in the contemporary welfare state, and many reforms are oriented to this. Second, you must cope with, respond to, what is often called moral hazard in welfare systems, which the kind of people who constructed the welfare state did not anticipate. Moral hazard refers to unintended and perverse consequences of policies instituted for other reasons. So that, for example, in the area of private insurance, if you get insurance against burglary, it sometimes means that you're much more casual about whether you leave your house locked up or not, because you know that you'll be protected. Moral hazard, therefore, is unintended consequences of actions. And we know that the traditional post-war welfare state was absolutely riddled with moral hazard. That is, it produced many consequences which are contrary to those which underlay the motivations which structured the policies which welfare systems created. The most obvious case, since there isn't much time left, is unemployment benefits. Unemployment benefits, we know now from numerous studies, were set up, of course, with perfectly good intentions to help people who lose their jobs. But since they were often just set up as passive risk systems, there wasn't any means of encouraging people to take jobs when jobs were available. The welfare state, therefore, quite often created cultures of dependency, which had the perverse effect, the outcome, of locking people out of good jobs when they could be in those good jobs. We now know that those aspects of labour market structures do have to be reformed in contemporary welfare states. And as I mentioned in the last lecture, we know that you can generate a lot of employment, especially in the contemporary EU countries, which the welfare state has actively helped prevent. So the perversities of the welfare state have to be tackled by contemporary political policies, and this is a sort of crucial aspect of them. Thirdly, the welfare state must respond to lifestyle change. A core aspect of the big changes I discussed in the first lecture. I'd like to offer an example of that from the pensions debate. The debate about the future of pensions is a crucial aspect of the debate about the future of the welfare state because, as I mentioned earlier, many welfare systems have got unsustainable pension commitments. There is not enough people to support the aging populations in contemporary societies. So there's a big debate about pensions throughout Europe and the industrial countries. However, this debate seems to me essentially very limited because it doesn't relate to the changes on the level of lifestyle that I discussed in the first lecture. We're living in a society with much more open lifestyles, in a much more open information society, where people are no longer imprisoned in the structures of tradition, traditional ways of doing things, habitual ways of doing things, and so forth. Well, these changes are affecting the very aging process itself. So that it won't do, when you're looking at the reform of welfare systems and political policies relevant to them, simply to concern yourself with so-called pensioners or how pensions are paid. In my view, you can treat pensions as an aspect of welfare dependency. The idea that you have to retire at a certain age is a creation of the welfare state. It was created by Bismarck when he set up sort of original welfare institutions in Germany, the forerunners of the welfare state in the late 19th century. But we now know that in contemporary conditions, when you get to a certain age, there's no reason why you should be declared unable to participate in work. There's no reason why you shouldn't be allowed, I think, to go on working no matter what age you are. Pensions have the effect of locking you out of the labour market. So rather than simply thinking about how you pay for pensions, we should be thinking about the whole changing structure of what old age means. Old age is changing in much the same way as all other aspects of people's individual lives are changing. We know, for example, that many of the diseases that used to be associated with old age were treated as a kind of passive outcome of old age, are actually lifestyle-related diseases. Many of the diseases of old age are not diseases of old age at all. They're the result of lifestyle practices which people can change. Now, when you look at Western European countries, what you see is you need more older people in the labour force, not fewer older people in the labour force. Some European countries, a little while ago, experimented with reducing the age of retirement because they thought it would help with unemployment. So in some regions of Germany and Italy, retirement age was reduced to age 60. That had the effect that companies treated people as redundant, as sort of old and out of it, by the time they're in their early 50s. It's exactly the opposite of the way you want to go. I think, therefore, no reason why you shouldn't have welfare to work schemes for older people. We now have a society where there's a very small younger generation. Why not think of abolishing pensions altogether? Abolishing pensions altogether means treating them simply as a form of savings. There's no reason, in my view, why you should have any formal age of retirement. People should have the right to work at any age, and you should have the right to hire them at any age. I think this is the only way, actually, that we'll be able to deal with the pensions crisis, which is coupled to a problem of employment in Western countries. You simply do not have a large enough younger generation coming into the labour force. Why not, therefore, allow older people to go on working as long as they want to, or as long as they're treated as useful workers by employers or by government? All of this means that, according to third wave policies, you don't want a passive welfare state, you want an active, what some people call an intelligent welfare state, that treats people as active citizens, not just as passive citizens, but actually rescues the welfare system. The crisis of the welfare state is not primarily a crisis of funding, not in my view. You'll continue to find these differences between different welfare states in the degree to which taxation can provide a basis for them. The crisis of the welfare state is really that the welfare state and its institutions became out of line, like so many of our other institutions, with the big social changes in the world, therefore producing circumstances in which welfare systems have begun to do the opposite of what they're created for. The welfare state is supposed to produce solidarity. It's supposed to produce an integrated society. But when you get strains and tensions, for example, between the generations over who is to pay for pensions, it's producing the opposite of that. When the welfare state creates more unemployment than it resolves, it's producing social division, not social solidarity. So the key aim of third wave politics should be to rescue the welfare state, to bring the welfare state into line with the demands of the new society which is emerging, and to reaffirm the fundamental task of the welfare state, which is to defend the public institutions of contemporary society. You cannot have a good society which is left to the vagaries of the market. You cannot have a good society without effective welfare institutions. Welfare state, a restructured welfare state, therefore is central to citizenship in contemporary societies, and to me that's the essential aim of what a left of centre party can effectively deliver. It can restructure the public domain so as to recapture an effective way of meeting the ideals which lay behind the early formation of contemporary welfare states in the first place. So although it's a long way ahead, I wish you a very happy holiday and look forward to seeing you all hopefully next term.